Community Radio.
It's about real people.
Not sound bites.
Not more talking heads.
Not on this show.
Interchange is a community access media forum fostering unfiltered open dialogue on the people, issues, and events impacting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
Conversations that challenge the ways we perceive the world around us.
Real people.
Real issues.
This is your forum.
This is Interchange.
Good evening. My name is William Morris, and I'm your host for Interchange. And I'm here today with writer and author Dan Ferber. Dan is a contributing correspondent for Science Magazine, and he has had articles appear in many other publications, including Popular Science, Audubon, and Nature Conservancy. Dan has recently co-authored a book called Changing Planet, Changing Health, How the Climate Crisis Threatens Our Health and What We Can Do About It. And today, Dan has come into WFHB to share some of his insight and expertise in this area. Dan, welcome to Interchange.
Thanks, William. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let's just jump right into the topic, okay?
Absolutely.
Dan, your book, Changing Planet, Changing Health. You co-authored this book with Paul Epstein. Can you tell us a little bit about your co-author?
Sure. My co-author, Paul Epstein, is Associate Director for the Center of Health and the Global Environment at Harvard Medical School. And he's been a leader in the field of climate change and health for 20 years. He is a physician and he is a public health researcher and expert. And he's done a lot of work in the developing world. So he has a global view of the subject, and he has a scientific view of the subject as well.
And according to the back of the book, it says that Paul has also contributed to the work of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 2007.
That is exactly right.
So this is a very serious co-author.
Yes, yeah. He's done a lot of great work.
Tell us a little bit about how the collaboration developed and came to be.
Sure. So the goal. Well, I guess I would take a step back and say climate change is our goals in writing this. Climate change is often portrayed as a distant threat, as or somebody else's problem, especially in the United States. You know, you think about Pacific Islanders who are losing their homes to rising sea levels. You think about Native Alaskans who are losing their homes to melting permafrost and polar bears and penguins. But one of the messages of this book is that it's affecting everybody and it's affecting us now. The project started with it actually was an editor at the publishing house who got us together, it was one of these expert writer collaborations, and that's how it got started, and it's been a true collaboration for the past few years.
And your expertise is in science writing,
right? I'm a journalist, and I've written a lot about science and the environment and health over the years.
And his expertise is in
public health and as a physician, and he's done a lot of work in the developing world as well, working in public health.
And his collaboration's worked out pretty good.
Yes, it has. It was a big project, and we each came at it from a different angle, and I think we complemented each other.
And it was how long in the making?
I'd say we started the project about 3 years ago, but we worked solidly for a year and a half on it, and that includes 7 months of reporting on my part, where I traveled to places like Kenya and Honduras to profile people who are at the front lines of this issue. A malaria expert in Kenya, a human rights activist and humanitarian in Honduras who has led the helped that country repair itself after Hurricane Mitch 10 years ago, and I went to Harlem Hospital and talked to a doctor who treats a lot of asthma patients there. So these are all connected with climate change.
And so there's a lot of stories in this book.
There's a lot of stories in the book. I mean, that was one of the goals. We wanted people because people relate to people. So there are people working on this issue already all over the world. This is affecting people. And the people that are most cognizant of it are the doctors and the public health workers and the scientists who study this issue. But then there are people already affected by various diseases or problems because the climate is changing and it's already affecting human health.
One of the questions that I've written down here is, in what ways do these changes harm our health? But before we go into that, what are some of the changes that we can see or that you write about in the book?
So some of the ways that the climate is changing. So people talk about global warming, and global warming is actually a bit of an unfortunate name because it almost makes it seem benign, and it's also only half the picture because the climate is warming, But in addition to that, the weather is getting wilder. The climate is getting more unstable. And the reason that's happening is because the oceans are warming up along with the atmosphere. And more warmer oceans mean more water vapor coming off, just like if you heat up a bathtub, you'll have more steam coming off, or a teapot. Same thing with the oceans on a global scale, more water in the atmosphere. And so it's more humid. What goes up must come down. It's a natural process that's sped up, so we get heavier rains. In this country, we've already had, over the past 40 years, an increase in rains of more than 6 inches in a day. So of 30% in 40 years. So it's already affecting this country, and we can see this right here in Indiana. We can see this in the flooding that we get in the springtime. It's not so much an individual rainstorm or flood you contribute to climate change, but over time, the average, there's more of it. So you get more Nashvilles like last year, and you'll get more Cedar Rapids like what happened in 2008. There'll be more flooding. So yeah, that's one thing. That's what's happening to the climate.
And of course, your average person is more looking at just temperature changes. When they think global warming, they look at it in some sort of macro picture. But the truth of what you're saying, which I think is very interesting, is that there's an instability to the weather.
There's an instability to the climate that's leading to more extreme weather, and it's the extreme weather that's potentially dangerous. The heat waves, the big storms, the ice storm like we saw this winter here in Indiana, these types of events will be more common as the climate warms, and they are becoming more common already. So that's one of the ways that it does affect health.
And what are some other ways that these changes harm our health?
So it's interesting. There are other ways. One of the other ways has to do with infectious disease. So especially the infectious diseases that are carried by insects, and in particular mosquitoes. So that's the reason I traveled to Kenya to report on this, where malaria is a big problem. And when I was in Kenya, I met the mom of a little girl, a 7-year-old girl who had suffered a life-threatening bout of malaria. And this was in an area of Kenya in the highlands near Mount Kenya. This is about a mile or more elevation. They never used to have malaria there, and it's gotten warmer. And because it's gotten warmer, the mosquitoes that carry malaria can live there now. So I traveled there with a malaria expert who happens to be this little girl's uncle, and we did some investigation. He did some investigation. I was just paying attention to what he was doing and talking to people. But he investigated, was malaria in this area? Because nobody knew at that point 3 years ago.
Are there other areas where we'd see this? I see – I think I saw something in your book about in Mexico and Honduras and Central America, closer to home. And when we think of Kenya, we're thinking across either Pacific if we go west or an Atlantic. But actually, it's closer than that.
Absolutely. It's closer than that. It's right here in North America. So all through the Americas. So the one of the main worries here – the big picture is that as climate warms – the tropics expand. They go to higher elevations and they go further away from the equator, and they can bring tropical diseases with them. And one of those diseases, one of the biggest worries is dengue fever. And dengue fever is rampant in the Caribbean and in throughout Latin America. It's a severe flu-like illness at best, and in rare cases it can promote internal bleeding and can kill people. It's a huge global problem. Last year, there was the first dengue fever outbreak in the United States in 65 years in Key West, Florida. And as climate has warmed, it's also moved from southern to northern Mexico. So it is poised to enter the southern United States. So that's a disease of the tropics that's making its way up. It's not the only problem. Already in this country, it doesn't have to be just tropical diseases. So Lyme disease is carried by a tick. And as it's gotten warmer in the Northeast, that tick has moved north. So in New Hampshire and Maine, that area has seen 10 times more Lyme disease than just 10 years ago, just 2000. So it is heading up.
So the contagion is also unstable.
Yes.
We talked about the instability of weather. There's also an instability to how we're accustomed to these contagions moving around.
Right. So as the climate gets warmer, the animals that carry these diseases adapt, and insects adapt very, very well. So they can move pretty quickly. They adapt better than we do in a lot of cases.
Another way that I think you've mentioned in the book about how these changes harm our health is heat waves.
Absolutely.
Could you talk to that a little bit?
Sure. Heat waves it's a huge public health problem. I think a lot of people underestimate how big of a health problem heat waves already is, and always has been. Heat waves kill 1,500 people a year in the United States, and that's from heat strokes and heart attacks from the excess of heat. And it's usually the older folks and the children and shut-ins. These are the people that get hit with heat waves. And as you look forward and you look at the climate models and you look, you know, what we're doing to the climate, what scientists predict, 30, 40 years from now, they're predicting a heat wave like the one that hit Chicago in 1995 every summer on average by the 2040s. So that heat wave killed 739 people. So we have to be prepared. Now, these are scenarios that we can change, but this is if we keep doing what we're doing now and don't change.
You know, as we're talking about infectious diseases spreading and we're talking about heat waves increasing, we talk about the instability of weather patterns globally. Is it the suggestion of the book that human beings are behind these changes and therefore human beings can change these patterns?
Absolutely. So the ultimate cause of our changing climate is the burning of coal, oil, and gas. Period.
And that's a bottom line that's reach in the book.
That's the bottom line. That's 80% of it. 20% of it is cutting down forests worldwide because forests soak up carbon dioxide that burning all of this stuff puts out. So those two factors are controlled by what we do as human beings. And we have a lot of influence and we've made a lot of changes to the planet over the past couple hundred years. We've put a lot of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere by burning all of these fossil fuels. Hundreds of billions of tons, and it's changing the atmosphere. So we have a lot of control over what happens over the next couple of decades by the choices of fossil fuels versus renewable energies, by protecting forests and much more.
There's a lot of things that need to be done.
There's a lot of things that need to be done, and there's a lot of things that can be done, and every single one of us has a role to play.
I was reading some statistics earlier today, and I'm not sure I'm going to get them right, except one of them I know is that today there are almost 6 billion people in the world, and they're projecting by the year 2050 there's going to be, I think, 8 billion people or more in the world. And we can only – if we think of the Earth as a ship upon which all of us travel, this is going to be a very crowded ship.
I agree. It is going to be a very crowded ship, and we have to think carefully about how – do we make the best use of the resources that we have? And one of the things that we try to promote in this book, we're talking about how can we become resilient? How can we roll with the punches? We're going to have to become more resilient as the decades roll on.
We've talked about heat waves, infectious diseases, extreme and unstable weather. And now another thing you talk about in the book is the disease of trees and plants.
Yes, it's surprising. It surprised me actually even when I first started working on this project. How could infestations of trees and plants? How does that affect us people? Well, it's indirect, but it's very important. So in the West, there are forests throughout the West. In Yellowstone, where I visited, and a lot of forests out there are being hit very hard by infestations of bark beetles. So these are beetles that come in by the millions and kill trees, and they kill whole stands of trees, and they're threatening entire areas. And they're getting, so you have that. You have a drying, warming climate out there. All of those things put together, you end up with tinder, and you end up with fires. And fires have gotten a lot more intense and a lot larger in the West. This is documented. There's also been some very good science linking them to climate change, the warming. If the probably the way to think about it is if you have a snowpack that comes later and melts earlier, you have a longer fire season, and that's what's happening out there. So you're getting less bigger areas that aren't covered with snow, so you're getting bigger fires, and these bark beetle infestations are affecting it too. So connecting it back to health, these fires. First of all, they're obviously dangerous by themselves. I mean, fires can hurt people. They can destroy a lot of homes, and they do. But the smoke from those fires is the biggest air pollution problem in the West. So the smoke from those fires, it's smoke inhalation. I mean, you have problems with bronchitis and asthma attacks. You also have problems with raise the risk of heart attacks from all the smoke inhalation. So this is happening wherever there's big wildfires.
Is there a continued spreading of these beetles too?
They see that? Keep going. They're going, and they've always been there. Okay, they're there. They belong there in at the lower elevations, and the trees and the beetles have a chemical warfare that's been going on for millions of years. And it used to be they'd fight to a standstill, and sometimes the beetles would win, and the trees would grow back. And now, at this point, especially at the high elevations, the trees at the high elevations never had those chemical defenses because it was too cold for the beetles. They would just die during when it got really cold in the winters. So these beetles are moving north into areas that used to be too cold for them. They're moving up into areas that used to be too cold for them. So I visited a mountain in Yellowstone. I climbed a mountain in Yellowstone Park with a bark beetle expert, 10,000 feet. This is a type of forest up there that anchors the entire – they call it the rooftop of the Rockies. It's the white bark pine forest, and it provides cover for lots of wildlife. There's really, really beautiful birds that live up there, and grizzly bears depend on it. And so those types of systems are in trouble, and bark beetles are moving north to higher – altitudes, and they're moving up to higher altitudes and moving north to higher latitudes, threatening a lot of forests in Canada, which was never affected by them before.
It's incredible, as I listen to you describe all of these things, that we're almost talking about catastrophes of biblical proportions. Yet when we listen to these discussions on the news about global warming, the effects of global warming, what we can do about global warming, there are so many naysayers out there who can't really buy into this for whatever reason, or say that it doesn't exist at all. Do we address that in the book?
Yes. We definitely talk about the evidence, how we know that the climate is changing. So we know from three aspects of science. First, science has first principles, the law of thermodynamics, the law of gravity. So from those first principles, chemists figured out 150 years ago that if you put a lot of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, that's part of what warms the Earth based on the properties of sunlight and carbon dioxide. So that's been long known. Then there's data on temperatures from thousands of weather stations worldwide. There's glaciers that are melting on mountaintops everywhere. You can go there and see it for yourself. You can see it in Africa. You can see it at Glacier National Park in Montana. You can see it all tropical mountains everywhere. Then there are models, and the models also are an important part of understanding how that works.
You're listening to Interchange. I'm William Morris, and I'm talking with Dan Ferber, the co-author of Changing Planet, Changing Health, How the Climate Crisis Threatens Our Health and What We Can Do About It. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Interchange. My name is William Morris, and I'm here with Dan Ferber, the co-author of Changing Planet, Changing Health, How the Climate Crisis Threatens Our Health and What We Can Do About It. At the end of the first section, Dan, you were talking about things that – how the book addresses quote-unquote naysayers or people who don't really embrace the idea that global warming or climate change really exists. And you were talking about some real scientific reasons that are covered in the book as to why those people should be more serious or convinced about global warming.
Yeah, there's no doubt that it's happening. And it's how we know. We talked a little bit about first principles, about understanding that how sunlight interacts with carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and how that creates the effect of a blanket over the Earth and warms the atmosphere. But also the fact that this has been measured in thousands of weather stations for many, many years, air temperatures, water temperatures. In addition to that, you have melting mountain glaciers all over the place, receding ice sheets. So this can be observed everywhere. What I was going to add to that is what models, and this is often the most controversial part of climate science, because they're computer models that take information and project what's going to happen in the future. So I want to clear up one of the misconceptions about that. Are they just people waving their hands? No, they can be tested. And the way they can be tested is you can take conditions from, say, 100 years ago, feed them into the models and see if they predict temperatures, for example, that have already happened. And when you do that, they predict these things very, very precisely. This is a way of checking these models. So that's part. And now if you take these models and you look at what's already happened and you take into account things that affect the climate, sunlight affects the climate, volcanic eruptions, and greenhouse gases, this carbon dioxide we're putting into the atmosphere and other gases. If you run those models and you take into account everything, it predicts what happened very nicely. If you take out all of the carbon dioxide and other gases that humans have put into the atmosphere, it does not predict what happens. So that's how we know they're accurate. And then there are more than a dozen of these models run by different people with different assumptions and different algorithms. They all come out to the same result. And what you end up – and I've covered science for a long time, and I have never seen such agreement among scientists. I mean, scientists are ornery folks. They like to argue with each other all the time, and they're very, very skeptical. That's what a good scientist does. But in climate science, there is no debate anymore. It's been settled for 10 or 15 years that this is happening and humans are responsible.
It's very interesting. As I listen to you, I'm thinking of fixed cost and variable cost. Mm-hmm. And there's a fixed cost in this model, which is sunlight, volcanoes, rain, storm, lightning, fires, and all of these things have been happening for years, mm-hmm. for all of history almost. And then there's the variable aspect, which is the human contribution to it.
Absolutely.
And that's the one that is, I guess, has this thing rolling.
Yeah, it's the ever since the start of the Industrial Revolution, you know, we have always affected the climate to some degree by cutting down forests throughout human history and by farming, but it's really ramped up since we started burning coal and oil and gas.
One of the other changes I think that we had talked about was respiratory diseases. We were talking about changes that harm how these climate changes harm our health. And we've covered a bunch of different things, but I think one thing we haven't covered is respiratory problems that are emerging.
Yeah, and it's a great question, William. This is happening right here in the United States. So to report the book, I visited Harlem Hospital in New York City, where there is an epidemic of asthma. And I was sitting in an examining room where a doctor named Ben Ortiz was examining a family, a mom and three little kids, and all of them had asthma, the mom and the three kids. And this, you know, it's July in New York City. It's very hot. It's going into the 90s. You can almost see the air. So it's a potential bad air day. So Dr. Ortiz asked the mom, you know, what do you do on these bad air days? And she says, well, we stay inside. The kids, of course, want to go outside and play like all kids, but they can't. And so this is a very debilitating thing for them. The connection with climate change there's three ways it connects with climate change. One is just the pollution from tailpipe pollution, smokestack pollution creates the bad air, the ozone that you hear about for the ozone alert days, it and the soot from burning diesel, all the black stuff that comes out of the truck tailpipes, that goes into the lungs. It infiltrates the fine airways of the lungs and irritates them and corrodes them. So it's very bad for respiratory. It promotes allergy attacks. And there's an interesting one that I hadn't heard of before I started working on this book, which is extra carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And there's more in cities than in the countryside. That makes ragweed produce more pollen and more potent pollen. So it aggravates allergies. And lots of us have allergies. I have allergies, right? And in the springtime and in the fall. And there is a connection with climate change. And the root cause of all of this is burning fossil fuels, which is the root cause of climate change as well. So that's the connection. And it is a very debilitating thing for many, many people around this country, particularly in cities, but not just in cities, who suffer from asthma and allergies.
Were you able to find out why specifically in Harlem this thing has were there any other cities, in other words, where you would see this same problem with asthma?
So it's asthma. First of all, rates of asthma have gone up. They're about doubled since 1980 in the United States.
Nationwide.
Another place where it's epidemic is in parts of Boston, Roxbury neighborhood of Boston, and it may be otherwise other places as well. In these areas in cities that get hot. And one other connection I mentioned, as the temperature goes up, and this is air pollution issues that affect all of us, as the temperature goes up, ozone smog forms faster. That's just chemistry. So the smog forms faster with the same amount of stuff coming out of tailpipes. So that's happening everywhere. Everywhere you have a city with a lot of people driving around, you have potential for that. So
of course, all of us are used to seeing those pictures of the clouds of smog hanging over Los Angeles. And for anybody who's ever traveled into Mexico City, you know, once you clear the mountains and begin to descend down in Mexico City, it's just a big cloud of pollution that covers that city.
Oh, yeah.
You'd wonder if the asthma rates are going up in Mexico City, if there's any data to that.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know about Mexico City, but it's happening definitely in the United States, that I'm familiar with, and it's happening in a lot of cities and all over the place from pollution. Mostly the air pollution triggers a lot of asthma attacks. Just to be clear, there's a couple of different causes of the higher rates of asthma, and that's still being – scientists are still working that out. Whether or not these pollutants are part of it, I don't know. But it definitely, for people who already have asthma, there's no question that they have worse asthma attacks and more of them.
One of the things about the threats of global warming, everything seems so insidious. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just here's more bugs, here's more insects, here's more infections, here's more asthma, here's all of these things that I'm not sure the average person just puts their arms around it. All of these little things are sort of building up a little bit at a time all around us, even if we're not aware of them. Mm-hmm. They're building up. And that leads me to ask you, those are some of the symptoms that we see now. Mm-hmm. Increased asthma, more dengue fever, mm-hmm. These other kind of diseases,
yeah.
Temperatures going up around the world, unstable weather. What are some of the biggest long-term worries that we should be thinking about as we look 20, 30, 40, 50 years ahead?
Okay, so we do talk about this in the book. We talk in Changing Planet, Changing Health. We talk about these types of connections. So what do we all need? We all need clean air to breathe. We all need clean water to drink. We all need healthy food, every single one of us, Republican, Democrat, conservative, liberal, it doesn't matter. We all need it. So looking into the future, we're talking about worries that natural systems that provide us these things, the forests and the wetland areas that purify water and purify air, they may have some problems. And one of the biggest threats worldwide is drought. And that gets right at the supply of fresh water for drinking, for bathing, and also for irrigation. Big picture, globally, what climate change is doing, it's making wet areas wetter and dry areas drier. That's one of the global changes. So in the interior of continents, basically getting drier. And
like
so,
Indiana.
Like Indiana. Like Oklahoma and Texas, which have a big drought going on right now. And we've seen droughts in the past 3 years. We've seen it in the Southwest. We've seen it in the Southeast. Atlanta almost ran out of water 3 years ago. very, very close. So these and Lake Mead in Nevada never will be the big bathtub rig in Lake Mead. That's never going to get fill up again. It'll never recover. So long term, we're looking at drought, and how does that affect health? So if you have less water, you have problems with sanitation, because there's in parts of the world there is not enough water for basic sanitation needs. Well, then you have problems with diarrheal disease. You have problems with skin diseases that happen in those types of environments. Also, you may not have enough in areas that need rain for farming. You may not have enough rain to produce enough crops and healthy food for people.
Which affects food supplies, which affects prices, which affects all of us.
Which affects food supplies, prices, and all of us, and it affects nutrition for people, because having enough good nutritious food is very important for health as well. So these connecting the dots is insidious, as you mentioned. It's in a lot of different ways. And one of the goals that I had in this book is to try to connect the dots for myself and for the readers, because I knew that, I mean, this is what I do for a living, and I was still having a problem connecting all these dots, and I figured I probably wasn't the only one out there who was thinking about that.
Are there any dots we've missed so far in our discussion? I think this idea of connecting the dots is interesting for me, and I'm sure for the listeners as well. Have we missed any dots so far that you'd like to touch on?
There's one, and it gets back to your last question, which is long-term threats. And this is an aspect of climate change that almost nobody is talking about. And it is the possibility that climate could change very quickly. There was a movie about this a few years ago called The Day After Tomorrow. And it was criticized for being inaccurate, and it was inaccurate. But the idea that climate could change quickly is a real possibility. It has happened many, many times in the history of the Earth, the past few million years. When I say quickly, I don't mean overnight, like you wake up one morning and there's a big ice sheet over Manhattan. What happens is over a period of a decade, but even as quickly as 3 years. And the way scientists know that is by looking at layers of ice representing every year in the Greenland ice sheet and layers of sediment, and you have records of past climates. And so they can see that this has happened numerous times, most recently about 13,000 years ago when we were coming out of the Ice Age. So if this happens, the climate that we're used to in Indiana, on the East Coast, on whatever it is, it can change very, very quickly. And the Pentagon actually ran a scenario, a planning project for this, because they're always ready for the worst case scenario. So I want to just be clear, this is a worst case scenario. There's a lot of things that won't be this bad. That probably won't be this bad. But if the climate flips, they were talking about a scenario in which global crop production drops 25%. You have drought. You have food shortages, even in the United States. In China, they can't produce enough food. They have famine. The U.S., southern U.S. had to militarize its borders because many people from the south wanted to come up. And so this is a worst case scenario, but it was a serious planning exercise that the Pentagon did about 5 or 6 years ago.
This is something similar to the computer models you talked about earlier.
Yes. It's similar. It's in that it's looking at the future. The technical stuff is a little bit different, but they're using the best information that they have available, best science, and taking the best educated guess at what could happen if this
in a worst case scenario.
Worst case scenario. Yeah. So. Yep.
One of the things, in your travels, because as we said earlier in the show, let's see, you went to Honduras and Kenya and Wyoming and Harlem and California. I think from reading this book and taking a look through it, you have really you're really giving the readers a global perspective of this problem. And I'm impressed by that.
Thank you very much. Yeah, we did want to give people a global perspective. My co-author, Paul Epstein, has a global perspective himself, and he thinks about global solutions. And we can talk about that a little more when we get into policy, but he talks about international policy solutions that are different than what people have talked about.
Dan, another question I wanted to ask is, which climate change solutions, if we're looking ahead in the next 30, 40 years, and you've given us a scenario of some things that could really happen in a worst-case scenario and otherwise, in not-so-bad scenario, but what climate change solutions give us the so-called biggest bang for our buck? How can we use our current resources? What's the best way to use our current resources to start to try to solve some of these problems?
Thanks for that question. There is so much we can do. So one of the things that Paul and I are proposing in this book is to think about climate solutions from a public health angle. In other words, the problem is that it's affecting us. Let's use the tools of the field of public health, which Paul Epstein is trained in, to solve the problem. And the way that the field of public health, the way public health workers think about this is it's good when people get sick, you have to treat them. That's what doctors do if there's an epidemic. It's better if you can predict, if you can see an epidemic coming or a heat wave coming and prevent people from getting sick. Best of all is if you can get at the root cause of whatever problem is. So that's the public health approach to preventing it. So in terms of predicting when things are going to get tough for people in specific areas at specific times, some of this is already happening in the United States, and we talk about this in Changing Planet, Changing Health. Heat wave early warning systems. So in 1995, Chicago did not have a heat wave early warning system, and 739 people died. That same year, the same mass of hot, muggy air moved to Philadelphia, and it's tragic that 18 people died in Philadelphia, but it's nowhere near 739 people.
The same body of warm air.
The same body of warm air. And the difference is this heat wave early warning system that says – that broadcasts over the airwaves just like we are now. It says you have this big, hot, muggy air moving in. Get to a place that's cool. Make sure to take care of yourself. And for the people that can't move themselves very easily, the shut-ins, the elderly, then you have people going out and helping them and moving them to cooling centers.
You're listening to Interchange, and I'm here talking with Dan Ferber, the co-author of Changing Planet, Changing Health, which was, I believe, released just this past week. Is that right, Dan?
That's absolutely right. It was released on Monday.
And I'm going to be back with Dan in just a minute after this break. Welcome back to Interchange. My name is William Morris. I'm your host, and I have the pleasure of being with Dan Ferber, the co-author of Changing Planet, Changing Health, How the Climate Crisis Threatens Our Health and What We Can Do About It. Dan, in the last segment, we were talking about solutions, long-term solutions that communities and individuals can participate in. One of the things you had mentioned was this heat wave warning system, which made me think, I wonder if there's a dengue warning system and different kinds of warning systems. Are there?
So yes, as a matter of fact, there are disease early warning systems, and that's one of the things that we're describing in this book. It's really no different than a weather forecast or a tornado warning system. It's just using the best information to say, when is this coming into town and can we prepare? So in the developing world, in a poorer country, if they know an epidemic's coming, they can move a lot of medicine to that area. They can have medics ready. So this has actually been developed, a scientist at USDA United States Department of Agriculture has developed a warning system for a very serious disease in Africa called Rift Valley Fever that can predict, based on satellite measurements of how green the countryside is and rain and other weather it can predict whether an epidemic of this disease is going to come in 2 to 4 months later. And the same fellow I was traveling around Kenya with, who works on malaria, has developed a computer model that can predict malaria outbreaks 2 to 4 months early. So that can save a lot of lives, and it already is in the case of Rift Valley Fever.
And what other kind of climate change solutions are we looking at in the future?
So there's so much that we can do and need to do. So it's basically all hands on deck at this point. So
everybody can do something.
Every listener to this show mm-hmm. can do something. So I just want to frame it with a big picture. So the big picture is that public health approach. This is about protecting human health and getting at the root cause of the climate change, which is burning fossil fuels. And what do we do? We move towards renewable energy. And that's happening in a lot of areas of our society. But we talk about just ordinary people who are doing this. They're not professional environmentalists or, in fact, a couple was a friend of mine, friends of mine over in Champaign, Illinois. They had to put in a new heating system in their house. And instead of putting in a conventional system, what they put in was a geothermal system, a ground source heat pump. And at the time, this is 9 years ago, this not too many people were doing that. Well, this saves them hundreds of dollars a year on their energy bills. The thing paid itself off in 7 years, and it saves a lot of carbon dioxide from going into the atmosphere from burning coal. And in Indiana, where 96% of our electricity is coming from coal, so anything you do to reduce that, it makes a big difference. We talk about a farmer who's putting in small-scale wind on his farm. We talk about a retired engineer who's part of a smart grid experiment.
Are these systems, though, somewhat, they're expensive sometimes, or at least people think they're expensive?
They are expensive. And so there are things that we can do that save money that right up front. Okay, putting in the compact fluorescent light bulbs, you'll save money on your energy bill next month. But these bigger investments, they take some help. So we actually talk about in the book some creative financing for how to finance this stuff. And this has to be done at the city and regional level. The city of Cambridge, Massachusetts pulled together $100 million from private and public sources, governments and banks, and what this money is doing, they're trying to weatherize half of the buildings in that city, which is an incredible amount. Just ordinary people, homeowners and business owners, and they're doing that by paying for the changes up front and getting paid back by the energy savings over a course of 7 years. So it takes some creative thinking sometimes. We have to think creatively. The world is changing. The climate is changing. We have to change too. We have to think creatively and come up with some of these solutions. But it's happening, and there's a lot of people doing this, and we talk about a lot of different approaches in the book.
So let's see if I understand this Cambridge model. The Cambridge mm-hmm. model is that they are going to somehow re-insulate or refurbish half of the existing buildings in the city mm-hmm. with the idea of making them more energy efficient.
Right.
The money which is saved from making the buildings that way will then go back to, because these are sort of the long-term profits,
right,
will go back to the city.
Yeah, the people that group that funded it is called the Cambridge Energy Alliance. And it's a way to get weatherize all these buildings for people who can't afford it. And they're just ordinary people. They're signing up voluntarily. Businesses, why do they sign up? They're signing up because they're saving all the money on energy bills. After they pay it off with the energy savings, the rest of the savings is theirs forever.
Are there any other municipal or governmental or large-scale solutions around the country that you'd like to talk about?
I would. There's a lot going on, and really every city has to get ready for a changing climate, and only a few are so far, but the ones that are have really taken a big leadership role. Chicago has really been a leader under Mayor Daley. So Chicago put in place a climate action plan 3 years ago. And they have, under Mayor Daley, they have planted 400,000 trees over 2 decades. They've trained workers to install renewable energy technologies. 200 miles of bike lanes already, with 500 planned by 2015. Green roofs to the building so they don't absorb as much heat, so the city doesn't get as hot. It makes life more pleasant, too, to have these green roofs on the buildings, these rooftop gardens. things like green buildings, make very energy efficient buildings, the LEED buildings. Smart growth, so cities grow in towards the center of the city rather than sprawling out so people have to drive 60 miles to get to work. More mass transit use. These are all aspects of healthy cities that there are healthy cities programs around the country, and Chicago's been a leader in that, and other cities can do it too. Indianapolis is, I think, just beginning this journey, but has a lot to do, and other cities as well.
Do we see any contribution from Washington in terms of healthy cities or healthy states? Or
Washington lately has been a little bit of a disappointment. At the time we were actually doing most of the writing of the book, which was 2009, President Obama had just come into office, and there was a lot of stimulus money going towards renewable energy, and a lot of good things were happening. For example, the standard for car and truck mileage was raised for the first time in many years. That's going to do a whole lot of good for the climate. Programs to weatherize homes were happening from the stimulus money. A lot of stimulus money going into the solar industry, the wind industry. And by the way, these aren't special favors for these industries like the coal industry would like to portray it. The coal industry and oil industry have been getting subsidized heavily for decades. So it's just a matter of where the subsidies go. And one of the things we talk about, why subsidize these damaging, polluting fuels when we can give these other industries an initial boost, like many industries have had, until they get their sea legs and get going. And this is happening, by the way, in Indiana. There's a lot of interest in wind and solar, and it's really taking off.
Have you seen any other interesting models or plans internationally?
So it's really very interesting, and this is one of the things that I learned from Dr. Epstein reporting the book, as he has done public health work all over the world in Mozambique and just all over the place, and he has this global perspective. The basic message from him: nations can't do it alone. We're not going to get it by pointing fingers at each other. China does this, India does that. We're all in this boat together. There's only one planet, and that's where we live. So we talk about international financial policy, what the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank have been doing for decades. And what they have a lot of what they have been doing in terms of policy has been quite damaging. They've got a lot of developing countries into a lot of debt. They force them to promote to grow cash crops, cut down forests and grow cash crops so they can pay back that debt. A lot of ordinary people in state-run companies are out of work because those companies were sold off to northern corporations, and there's no incentive for them to just simply employ people for the sake of employing people. That creates poverty. Poverty is a well-known factor in making health worse worldwide. One of the things we talk about is tweaking those international financial rules and so that you can get countries all over the world, developing countries. Number one, we need them to protect their forests. If you cut down in Indonesia, if you go to Indonesia and say, we need cash, and Indonesia cuts down its rainforest so it can make a palm oil plantation, which has happened all over Indonesia, you have a problem because you just lost all that rainforest. We have a problem because we just lost all that rainforest. So, and not only that, but the money goes out of the country and not to Indonesians. It goes to corporations in developed countries. It tends to do that, and to a wealthy elite in every country, which is why it happens. So you change those rules so that you can make countries able to invest in public health. This is about health and protect the health of their citizens. Have the countries protect their forests, their coral reefs, their mangroves, all of the things that we know we need them so much. We need them to protect our climate. So that's the goal of the various solutions that we get at. One of the things that we promote internationally is something that already exists, but way too small of a scale, which is a big fund to help these countries move towards renewable energy. Because if we don't help them, they're just going to go for the quickest energy source, which is some kind of something to burn. It might be wood in some cases, but that's bad too. And it might be coal or something. So if we can help these countries get in early and not go take 100 years like we took to come around, because we don't have 100 years, and then we can help them move to renewable energy, move globally. That promotes the industry, the renewable energy industries globally, and it's good for everybody.
If there's one thing that has the possibility of promoting a global solution, it's going to have to be this problem.
Absolutely. This is a global crisis, and it is about the health. It is about our health, but it is even more so about the health of our children. It is about the health of our grandchildren. I have kids. I think about what kind of world are they going to live in 30 or 40 or 50 years. I probably won't be here in 50 years, but my kids will. And I want this to be a livable world. I want this to be a healthy world.
If you were going to advise each of us in the WFHB listening area, just a list of one, two, three things that we can all do to start to chip in. And I think most people have some idea, but just from your own experience, one, as the writer of this book, and two, as a member of the Indiana community, because you're from Indianapolis.
Absolutely.
Or at least you're based in Indianapolis now.
I live in Indianapolis. Yes.
Tell us three things each of us can do to help this situation.
First, I think that everybody needs to educate themselves and deal with and just be aware of the reality of what's happening. And that tends to be difficult with a lot of the misinformation and disinformation that's out there. But it is certainly possible. If for the climate deniers and skeptics out there, there's a very good website called skepticalscience.org that tackles all of the climate skeptic arguments that sound good on the surface but are inaccurate. So number one, educate yourself, become aware. Number two, just do one. Think about what one thing can you do. Do one more thing that will reduce your carbon footprint and live a little bit greener.
Such
we can
as?
All do that. For example, riding your bike for short trips of a mile or two, if that's something that you do. Taking the bus. We don't have much of a train option in Indiana, but we have bus options. Putting geothermal system is if you have a little more money to invest. Changing the light bulbs in your house to the fluorescent, or even better, the LEDs when their price comes down a little
There's
bit.
Talk of a train system nationwide and even in Indiana, I think. What is your take on that as a device which would reduce the carbon footprint?
So if you're referring to the trains that run between cities?
Trains between cities, yes.
Okay. So those – I think it's important, and it's important – it's going to reduce – the idea of that is to reduce those short airline flights, because airline travel, air travel is one of the biggest contributors to – pound for pound to climate change. And if we can take those 200-mile trips by train, by a fast train rather than by a get on a plane from Indianapolis to Chicago or something like that, you're saving a lot of pounds of carbon from going into the atmosphere. It's a very good idea.
So education is one way we could all improve or we could all participate in this battle. Another way is each of us to just take on one more step, take one additional step, use a bicycle, change our light bulbs, turn off our lights, shorter showers, something along this line. And one third thing, Dan?
Okay, I think we need to be aware of what our elected representatives are doing, what they're saying, what they're doing. There is a lot of denial right now in Washington. There is a lot of misinformation, and I think we need to realize this is a public health crisis, just like it was in 1970 when Rachel Carson came out with Silent Spring and a lot of toxic chemicals were infecting birds. And so this is a much bigger public health crisis, because you can't turn the clock back on this one. Once the stuff's in the atmosphere, it's in the atmosphere. So we need to hold our elected officials to a much higher standard and ask them very seriously to ask them to get serious about taking steps. The steps that they can take are available if they look in the right places. For elected officials at every level of government, there are people doing this nationally. So if we realize there is no such thing as economy versus the environment, the economy is part of the environment. I mean, we can't exist, without a healthy functioning environment. So I think we need to hold our elected officials' feet to the fire a little bit and encourage the ones that are doing the right thing.
We've been here talking with Dan Ferber about his book, Changing Planet, Changing Health. Dan, can you tell us how we can get some more information about your book?
Absolutely. You can find more information at the book website, changingplanetchanginghealth.com. You can follow us on Facebook. There's a Facebook page for Changing Planet, changinghealth.com. It is available in bookstores everywhere. It is available at online retailers everywhere.
Thanks for your time, Dan.
Thank you very much, William. It's been a pleasure being here.
Thanks to our assistant producer, Shane Young, for engineering tonight's program. Interchange is produced by William Morse. The executive producer is January Jones, and our original theme music is by Jamil Effiam. Stay tuned for Stardust with Brother Tillman, coming up next, right here on your community radio station, WFHB.
Real people.
Real issues.
This is your forum.
This is Interchange.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers working in the studios of Community Radio WFHB in Bloomington, Indiana.
Interchange fosters unfiltered open dialogue on the people, issues, and events impacting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
Comments, suggestions, and program ideas may be sent directly to the Interchange staff.
The email address is news@wfhb.org.
That address once again is news@wfhb.org.